This morning, from Hong Kong, we have the founder and managing partner of Kinetic joining us. Kinetic is a blockchain platform focused on technology, advisory, asset management, community, and venture capital investments in the space. In addition, he comes from a deep background in the art world. Please welcome Jihan Chu. Jihan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And how are things over there in Hong Kong in light of COVID?
It's actually okay. I think Hong Kong's done a pretty good job of managing it and, you know, keeping infections down to a minimum. It's a bit restrictive. It's a bit difficult to get back in, but, you know, I think that they're doing their best.
I'm happy to hear that. Let's jump into the first question for the day, shall we?
Great.
So Jihan, tell me about yourself and your background and how it led you to the path of starting Kinetic.
Yeah, I actually didn't study technology, but I learned how to, you know, make web pages in college back in the late 90s. And when I graduated, I was a front-end developer deep in the heart of the first dot-com boom. I was just coding away. And I was recruited by Sotheby's, the auction house, for my second job. And I was, you know, lucky to help them launch a lot of their, you know, online auctions back in the early 2000s. And had the opportunity to move to Hong Kong when they were expanding the office. So did that in 06 and left in 08 to become an art dealer. I'd really gotten into the art world, loved collecting myself, and was just, you know, very passionate about art and culture. So left Sotheby's and went on my own, basically helping ultra high net worths build art collections. In 2013, I got into Bitcoin, just fell down the rabbit hole and spent the next couple months just delving in and investing, and was fortunate to start the Ethereum community in Hong Kong. So I started the Ethereum Hong Kong meetup back in early 2014. And that's when really things really started to take off. I went much deeper into blockchain applications and built my own community and learned a ton from so many great founders that came through my meetup over the years. Then in 2016, I started Kinetic, which, you know, we're very fortunate to have become one of the, you know, leading investors in blockchain and crypto in Asia, having invested in, you know, over 220 companies and some of the brightest lights and really, you know, impressive companies in this space, including, you know, Parity, Polkadot, FTX, Solana, you know, BlockFi, Alchemy, Decentraland, and a lot of really great companies. So we've had an enormously fortunate journey to meet a number of great founders and you know, do our part in helping them to develop and helping the ecosystem develop.
So Jihan, going off that point, what is Kinetic? You are this advisory asset management venture capital firm. It seems kind of like a one-stop shop for a crypto enthusiast in a way.
Yeah, we've gone through a couple of different iterations. Our first iteration was really just investing our own money. This was back in 2016. It was myself and my former partners who started this. I was really the blockchain guy, and they were, you know, kind of friends of mine and friends that were kind of brought in from the traditional finance world who were interested to kind of learn more about the space. So I was doing this investing on our behalf, and it kind of blew up. I mean, 2016, 2017, we got lucky on a number of really, really early deals like Qtum, Ethereum crowd sale, Gnosis, 10x status, a lot of these early generation companies, Icon, which, you know, were, you know, thousands and thousands of percent, you know, kind of gains. And we spun that into a larger business doing advisory, helping token projects to launch, doing community events and conferences, doing trading, and even structured products. But when crypto winter came around, we decided that, you know, the environment was becoming unpredictable, and, you know, my former partners didn't really want to go at it anymore. So they either retired or kind of went back to their normal businesses. But I wanted to continue doing it. So myself and my brought on one of my friends who had been working for us, Tony Gravanis at the time, who's my partner now, we decided to continue investing. And so Kinetic today is really just a VC. We are investors. We, you know, have a very focused thesis in terms of how we look at investing in the space, but we don't really do anything else other than invest and incubate companies. So you can think of us really as like a traditional VC.
And recently there has been a lot going on in the gaming, metaverse, NFT, and blockchain convergence space. Where do you see the big moves in APAC over the next 5 years, particularly happening in this industry?
In blockchain in general, I've always believed that Asia is actually the engine of blockchain growth and adoption globally. And that's not a very popular opinion. I think a lot of people would think that it really comes from, you know, the US and maybe Silicon Valley. But in actuality, there's an incredible amount of adoption, especially enterprise adoption of blockchain applications in China. A lot of people don't really know this because it is a bit, you know, difficult to kind of understand with the language barrier and the information barrier. But there is a lot of permission ledger and smaller, you know, maybe less popular chains, especially semi-decentralized ones that are really active. There's a ton of blockchain applications that are used by, you know, Huawei and Ping An and, you know, Ant Financial. So I think that the region has so much potential given the kind of natural resources for development in China. Plus you add on the, you know, incredible potential of Southeast Asia. The population of Indonesia and Malaysia and India all together has an incredibly, incredibly rich and ripe kind of field of user bases who can really benefit from going directly from Web 2 to Web 3 and deploying blockchain technologies, whether they're decentralized or semi-decentralized. So I think Asia is actually low-key one of the most exciting opportunities and probably the biggest opportunity for real adoption. In terms of gaming, obviously China, Korea, Japan, Asia in general is a hotbed for gaming activity. There's incredibly digitally native and gaming native populations here where gaming, you know, it's really the kind of cradle of casual gaming globally. And I think that is translating over to blockchain games, everything from P2E to metaverse. I don't think it's any coincidence that the whole notion of guilds and, you know, play to earn has come from Asia. So I think that we're going to see a lot more of this develop. And, you know, with these digitally native kind of communities and, you know, with the opportunity set of, you know, developing world and just the sheer numbers, I think Asia is really set to kind of excel in the next couple of years all across blockchain, especially gaming.
Yeah, I have to say P2E is quite interesting with giving people in low mid income countries access to alternative types of income, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it really will change the nature and really play to earn is just the beginning. We've heard of things like learn to earn and all these different variations of the blank, you know, X to earn model, all kind of leading back to different gamification of labor in a digitally native economy and a digitally native labor force.
So Jihan, kind of going off what you just said, what have been some very high level exciting business models which have stood out to you in the space so far?
I think one of the business models that we're really excited about is true fundamental decentralization of, you know, resources. One of the best examples I can think of is our portfolio company Render, RNDR. The website is rendertoken.com, R-E-N-D-E-R token.com. And they take a very traditional internet style business, which is 3D graphics processing. So think Avengers Endgame, think Westworld. All of these, you know, 3D graphics were rendered using the parent company Otoy, their Octane platform, and it's really, you know, one of the market leaders in 3D graphics processing. But as they were doing all this work for these Hollywood studios, what they found is there wasn't enough processing power in the normal cloud systems. So they created the Render Token Network to make use of gamers' NVIDIA cards, their high-end gaming rigs, where they can rent these really high power rigs to the network while they're sleeping and earn money while they're sleeping and their rigs aren't being used. So it's a really great way to utilize idle resources and provide resource to, you know, a problem set, which is 3D graphics processing, which is cheaper, which is faster, which is more distributed and more available and more accessible in a way which is very natural. So we love the business models which are win-win-win. And we think Render Token is extremely exciting and has, you know, recently been featured at, you know, the Solana Breakpoint Summit and, you know, a lot of places. So we're incredibly excited to have been an early investor in that and excited to, you know, kind of continue supporting them as, you know, as they kind of continue the journey.
And in addition to this, anything else that you feel like really stands out or is going to be the next innovative thing in the space?
I think that metaverse and this idea that I'm calling Augmetaverse is extremely exciting for me to think about. And I think a lot of people are starting to think about it as well. I think there's metaverse, which we know of, you know, Decentraland and Sandbox, Somnium, all these traditional decentralized metaverses are very exciting. But I think what we're going to see is actually the metaverse starting to extend into the physical universe or the physiverse in a way which starts to create a more seamless proposition for experience. So take, for example, let's say you buy an object like a vase or something like that. And that vase has an NFT that's attached to it. And then NFT is that representation of that vase. And that NFT actually can be placed in your metaverse home. So if you have a home in Decentraland, you can put that vase in your home. But at the same time, if you're wearing, say, you know, Apple Glass, you know, when they come out and you can experience AR, the ability to actually have that vase exist in another format, which is virtual, visible through AR, but have a different layer of experience than the physical vase. Say, for example, the AR vase can actually show you the different types of information about that vase, where it came from, who made it, what the material is, how much it cost, who used it before you, and all these different experiences. I think these kind of seamless experiences across the physical universe, the AR universe, and the metaverse will be this new way you know, that we as consumers and we as a culture, as a digital culture, start to experience things. And we're excited about companies like Matterless, which is doing AR NFT pets. So an augmented reality pet that's an NFT. Think of a cat that you can see only if you look through your AR glasses, but which you can interact with. You can feed it, you can have it do tricks, you can pet it, you know, a true companion. These types of things are very exciting. And I think that we're going to see really, really innovative ways of people having a much richer and more rewarding digital experience through the combination of these different interfaces, but then also with blockchain and NFTs to enforce that, you know, uniqueness and that, you know, ownership layer, whether you're in the physical universe, the augmented or the augmetaverse itself. I really think we're going to have this blended experience where we do spend more time in the digital space, where we're experiencing things. You know, we can have that kind of Ready Player One, that snow crash experience. But at the same time, I think that AR and these blended experiences will also see us getting more richer experiences out of our physical interactions. So I think it's going to be a bit of a mixture. The one kind of twist I would throw on that is I do think it's going to depend on your socioeconomic level and your ability to have resources. If you are, you know, in the, you know, the more fortunate and developed world, and you have access to, you know, clean water and, you know, safe, you know, streets and infrastructure, it's going to be easier to make that decision to spend, you know, equal time in both the metaverse as well as, you know, your physical reality. But if you're in a developing world where your physical surrounding is really not great and you don't have a lot of options, I think that what we'll see is it will start to create, you know, a better life for people who are less fortunate being in the metaverse and being more digitally online, where online people don't know, you know, who you are, where you come from. You're not bound by your physical reality and your physical infrastructure other than your bandwidth and your, you know, your computer or your phone. And it becomes this great equalizer. So I do think that it'll be interesting to see how socioeconomic access plays out in the metaverse, where the metaverse may offer more benefits to those who are less fortunate. And I think that may start to kind of create maybe opportunities, I hope, for those less fortunate who are able to get online and able to, you know, spend time. And it might even create a leg up for them, you know, if there are more of them who are experiencing this. Whereas those of us who are fortunate enough to be in the developing world, and we don't, you know, really have as many issues and problems and things to face and challenges as people in the developing world do, we have that optionality to log out of the metaverse and go have a nice meal and you know, go hang out with our friends at a bar or see a movie. So socioeconomics, I think, is a very unexplored aspect of how the metaverse community will develop.
So in a nutshell, you could say it's a way for people to really restart their lives if they really want to, right? Gives them an alternative solution that if they're not happy with their physical reality, they can go to this virtual world where opportunity and socioeconomic, you know, equity is there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we even saw this in Ready Player One, right? Where the main protagonist was, you know, very poor and lived in a trailer park, like a, you know, a contemporary trailer park. I think that, you know, the metaverse really is a land of opportunity. It's a digital universe of opportunity. And I think that, you know, we really have an opportunity to make it into that and use it and shape it in a way where it can be that promised land for people that are less fortunate.
Now, Jihan, taking a slight turn in the conversation, prior in the call, you had mentioned that you spent quite a few years at Sotheby's, a top auction house, one of the top two auction houses around the globe today. And over the past year, Sotheby's has really, you know, pushed into launching an NFT exclusive marketplace and even allowed bidding on crypto. What has your activity been like with NFTs recently in this last year?
Yeah, there's been an incredible amount of activity in the auction house space in general. And just to clarify, I used to work for Sotheby's, but now I'm actually an advisor. I'm the crypto advisor to Christie's globally. So I actually do work with Christie's in an official capacity. But regardless of that, you know, I think both of the auction houses have done an incredible job of putting NFTs at the forefront, not only of the market, but really a popular culture. Actually, the first NFT that was ever sold at a major auction house was one that I actually own myself of the same series, which was Ben Gentile's Portrait of a Mind. It was a painting that had an NFT attached to it. That was actually in October of 2020, I believe. It wasn't until 2021, I think, when Beeple's work sold for $69 million. And that was really the, you know, the starting gun for NFTs in popular culture. So I think the auction houses are continuing to do a great job of making a diversity of NFTs available, whether it's art, whether it's collectibles, whether it's architecture with, you know, Krista Kim's kind of architecture NFTs. And I think in the future, they'll continue doing that. But I think that auction houses only play one part. What I'm really interested in is some of the experiments and developments with cultural institutions like museums who are increasingly getting into the space. I'm working with a company now who's not announced yet that's working with a major American art museum to develop a art exhibition, which is in Decentraland, which is super exciting. So there's so much to be done. There's so many kind of avenues that people are exploring in the art NFT side. So it's a really, really exciting time, and it's just really hard to keep up. I think we ourselves have invested in something like 15 or 20 different NFT platforms, including TR Lab, which is a fine art auction NFT set, Eternity, which is doing collectibles, and companies like Forte, which is gaming NFT infrastructure, which recently did, I think, around at, you know, I think they, it's like something ridiculous, like $3 billion or something like that. So you know, there's so much development going on all in different places.
And Jihan, are there any exciting NFTs that you have sold yourself that have, you know, returned well, or certain collectible assets that you hold on to and the reasons maybe behind those?
Yeah, I'm not really a seller. I'm more of a collector myself. I buy NFTs, but I don't really sell them. For me, I'm excited just to, you know, try to build what I hope will be a historical and valuable collection of NFTs that help to document the early history of a particular section of NFTs. And that's really fine art. You know, unfortunately, I missed the entire, you know, ape and punk wave. I was never really interested in the collectible side, and visually they're not as exciting for me compared to like the fine art, which is really my main interest. So I was always focused on the fine art side, and I'm lucky to have collected things like Andy Warhol's, one of Andy Warhol's five NFTs that were issued by the Andy Warhol Foundation and sold at Christie's. So I bought a flower, basically an Andy Warhol digital flower, which is like the crown jewel of my entire art collection, both physical and digital. I collect Beeple work pretty extensively. I collect Rafik Anadol, and it was his immersive room that I bought at the digital art fair in Hong Kong alongside Sotheby's, which is the first immersive room NFT. So I think that that's also a pretty important piece because it's the first time that an NFT has been offered as like a physical space. And again, it's that blending of the physical and the digital and NFT and blockchain, which I think makes it a historical work. So I'd say those are some of the really, you know, important pieces. I also collect work by Ash Thorpe, who's an incredible filmmaker and artist, and Andre Reisinger, who's blending interior design, design objects with NFTs. So I'm really looking for artists who are at the top of their game, who have a very critical eye, and who I hope are, you know, helping to define pathways for future artists to expand, you know, ideas and practice in the NFT space, regardless of whether it's art or design or architecture or fashion or what have you.
So I hear you're a big fan of mindfulness and meditation, and you're really focused on tackling the self-development side. What kind of event in life caused you to go after this? In addition, I wanted to add, what have these things done for you? How has it changed your life?
Yeah, I have to say that I'm very fortunate in the sense that there was no, you know, one incident, no kind of trauma, fortunately, that pushed me to it. In fact, I've just always been really curious. For those, you know, listeners who don't know, Vipassana is a mindfulness breathing technique that Buddha taught. It's been practiced by, you know, a lot of different people over, you know, really centuries. It's a centuries old practice. And it's just a breathing practice. It's not a religion at all. It's a mindfulness. It's the root of all mindfulness practice. You know, it's a 10-day silent retreat where all you do is meditate, eat, sleep, and learn about meditation. And that's pretty much it. You know, you can't talk, you can't read, you can't write, you can't, you know, make eye contact with people. It's very intense. It's an incredibly rigorous but rewarding process of not just introspection, but self-development in terms of really clarifying what the mind is both made of and capable of. So I did that back in 2004, and I regularly, you know, revisit the practice and try to meditate, you know, when I can. It was actually even Albert Wenger, who is one of the original partners at Union Square Ventures, the fabled, you know, New York venture capital firm, who also said to me during one of my Kauffman Fellows program presentations, you know, he said to the class, you know, if there's one thing you take away from my talk, it's have a mindfulness practice, whether it's walking, running, whatever it is, have some type of mindfulness practice. And for me, it's just been an incredible, you know, way to be not just in control, but to see myself and to be able to feel myself in a way. And I think the benefit I've gotten from, you know, being a Vipassana practitioner is to reduce the suffering, not just in my life, but in the lives of people around me to an extent, because a lot of the pain that I think we as humans accumulate we reflect it and we magnify it and we share it. And what Vipassana has done for me is to help me not bottle the pain or the, you know, any kind of stress, but to, you know, observe it and let it go and dissipate it so that I'm not inflicting it on people and, you know, making, you know, vicious cycles of kind of pain and suffering and stress in the world. So I think, you know, it, nobody needs Vipassana, but I think everybody can benefit from it. And for me, I think that everybody would live longer, less stressful, healthier lives, just, you know, by going through this practice. But to be frank, it was like the toughest 10 days of my life. It's not easy, but it's incredibly, incredibly worthwhile. And I recommend it to everybody. And if anybody's interested to check it out, it's dhamma.org, dhamma.org. It's free and it's amazing.
And there was a point that you alluded to earlier in the conversation. You had this amazing opportunity to join the Kauffman Fellows Program, which is one of these very, very exclusive venture capital programs. What does this program entail and how has it helped you grow your career as a VC?
Yeah, the Kauffman Fellows Program, I think, is really one of the most amazing training programs for investors and investment industry professionals out there. It's a 25-year-old program, which basically helps investors, primarily VCs, with personal development as well as professional development. So think of it as like an exclusive kind of MBA for VCs, but also really focusing on the community of VCs as well, and also personal development, you know, how to be a better person, not just a better investor. And it is an application-based program. It is pretty difficult to get into. There's only 60 people in my class. And I think there's, you know, hundreds that apply, maybe even over 1,000 that apply each year. So I was very fortunate to be the first blockchain crypto VC to be admitted to the program. And I'm graduating from the program. It's a two-year program. I'm graduating in this June. But when I came into, I never apprenticed as an investor. I was an art dealer and I became a crypto investor just because of my interest, but no one taught me how to do it. And there was a lot of basic stuff and experience that I just didn't have in the traditional investment world, and, you know, because I was never trained. And I think that the Kauffman Fellows Program has given me access to an entire network of peers who are much smarter than me and much more experienced in traditional venture capital, who have really taught me not only what it means to be a responsible investor, but also some of the tips and tricks, and, you know, help guide me through a lot of the different types of scenarios, both professionally, and we also share with each other personally, you know, what's happening in our lives, some of our trials and tribulations. And on the other hand, I've actually been able to really educate them about blockchain and crypto. And, you know, there's a lot of deal sharing. So I've even gotten a lot of them to invest in blockchain and make their first, you know, kind of crypto purchases. So it's really been an incredible program. I encourage everybody to look into it who's, you know, in the VC space. You know, whether you're a family office or private equity or anything like that, they're open, and it's really kind of an unparalleled program for investors.
So coming from this mindfulness, meditation, and venture capital perspective, what piece of advice would you give to people out there from the journey you have had so far in life?
I think that it's important to try and be true to yourself. I know that's a very well-trodden phrase and idea, but it's really not easy to clarify who you are, what you want, how to clarify authenticity of self, and to really stay aligned with yourself when things are going bad, or even harder when things are going well. I think that the more you can focus on just being true to your own voice, whatever that voice is important. And then, you know, and then trying to just build on that. I think, you know, if your calling is to be an investor, I think the most important thing is to just learn how to be helpful, and how to support your founders and the whole ecosystem. I think that the notion of, you know, being a venture capitalist is changing, especially with blockchain, as things, as the whole nature of VC changes into, you know, different speeds of investing, different modes of investing, more community-based investing. And I think that VCs really have to reconsider how they operate, and, you know, not just kind of fall back on the traditional, you know, modes of investment. The world is changing very, very rapidly. It's becoming more decentralized. It's becoming more interoperable. It's becoming, you know, more peer-to-peer. And it's demanding all of us, not just as investors, but as people, to think deeper about how we, you know, interact, how we do business, and how we, you know, connect with people. That creates a lot of opportunity, but also a lot of responsibility. And I think investors in particular have, you know, a really, you know, great opportunity to shape a lot of that, because we are the ones who are, you know, curating and supporting and helping to grow the, you know, the applications that will help to define our time. I mean, imagine the conversations that the VCs that invested in Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and, you know, Signal and all these things that we take for granted, Google, Chrome. These are the opportunities that are happening in front of us now, because Web3 is arguably even more important than Web2. And now is the time when investors in this space really can make a difference. So I would really encourage all the crypto investors, whether you're buying, you know, tokens, you know, on your MetaMask with, you know, $100, or whether you're managing like a $2 billion fund, to really think about the responsibility of, you know, what we're building, and, you know, try to do it a little bit better than those that came before us.
And Jihan, for listeners out there who are interested in potentially catching a cup of coffee with you, or meeting you in person, what would be the best point of contact?
Yeah, best thing to do is you can, you know, try and hit me on LinkedIn, Jihan Xu, or you can follow my Twitter at Collectionist. Or my Mirror Twitter, which is at Jihan Xu, but at Collectionist, Collectionist, is my main Twitter. So yeah, look forward to connecting with people there.
Jihan, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.